White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, listeners and students of the International Jew. This is episode 20 on November 8th, 2012. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm joined by Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Hi, Hadding. Well, tonight we have a longish chapter about Jewish influence on the American farm through land and real estate and commodities speculation, basically. And it's quite interesting, I think, even if you might not expect it to be. Ford's writers get pretty heated in this chapter. Did you think so when you were reading it, Hadding?
Well, yeah, it was current and pressing news for them.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you were just saying that that there was what kind of depression was it in the 19?
Well, it says there's actually a Wikipedia article about it. The depression of 1920 to 21. It says the recession lasted from January 1920 to July 1921, or 18 months. This was longer than most World War II recessions, but was shorter than some other recessions, significantly shorter than the Great Depression. Let's see. Well, anyway, they had a recession, and then there was a brief period of prosperity. Then there was deflation.
Okay. Well, that's good background. Well, you can, as we're reading along here, we can check and see how it fits that. Well, this would be 1920. Where are we now? We're still in. Are we still in 1920 for the?
Yeah, August.
This one might be September 1920. So it hasn't even really gotten started yet. All that stuff that went on in the 20s. Okay, right. Well, our chapter is How the Jewish Question Touches the Farm. It's chapter 16, ladies and gentlemen. And if you follow along in the book, that's what it is.
Yes. How the Jewish Question Touches the Farm. The real estate speculations of the Jews are familiar to all, but unfortunately do not constitute their entire land program. Many American cities have changed their characters entirely during the past 15 years by reason of Jewish speculation in residence property, and it is a fact established in the larger eastern cities that the recent exorbitant and extortionate rise in rents was largely a matter of the Jewish landlord. The governor of one of the most important of our commonwealths was loath to sign a bill regulating rents. His hesitancy was encouraged by very heavy pressure brought to bear upon him by the weightiest Jewish financial interests in his own and neighboring states. He finally decided that he would sign the bill and give the law effect, and the fact that decided him was his personal investigation and the investigation of his personal agents into hundreds of cases of abuse where he discovered that it was a common practice among Jewish landlords to transfer the same piece of property round and round to every member of the family in turn, each transfer being the excuse for a new increase in the rent.
That's like things we've even seen in movies and stuff. I mean, this is just so typical. People don't even fully think anything wrong about it, you know. Well, like, it's, if they can get away with it, well, why not? You know, it's not illegal. I guess it's not illegal, right?
Unless there's a law against it. It's one of those things that doesn't need to be legal if you don't have if you don't have a particular group within your society conspiring, then you don't have to worry about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's like insider trading. Something like that.
Well, we know, when you are renting something and you keep the same landlord, they usually don't like to raise the rents on you, unless they really have to, not too much. But
there might even be some regulation about it. I don't know.
Well, some things that are regulated would be, but if they're not regulated, then it wouldn't. So there they go. They say, well, I sold the property. They tell their renters. And then the new landlord comes along and says, well, I have to raise the rent. This is the new rent. Ah, that's the cheesy stuff they do. Okay, sorry for interrupting there.
He said, it's interesting. He says Jewish financial interests brought pressure on that governor. And the reason why high rents are necessary, one reason anyway, is to make buying rental property on credit workable. Because buying properties on credit to rent them out means you have to charge high rents.
Why?
Because you're paying money lending also.
Yeah. Okay.
Indirectly. Men have their eyes open to the Jewish question in various ways. This was the way a governor had his eyes opened. That, however, is not the peculiarity of Jewish landlords alone. Gentile landlords have played the same trick, but landlordism is peculiarly a Jewish ambition and distinction. The Jew is the landlord of America. That's quite a statement. Any group of tenants almost anywhere in America except the West could testify to this.
Well, that is quite a statement. And you know, I had a great uncle who was the wealthiest member of the family, my mother's uncle, and he was a big landlord. Everything he did was like the Jews do. He thought like a Jew. He must have, well, nobody else did, so that doesn't mean that he was Jewish, but he just had that, you know, that greedy quality, and he wanted to succeed and get ahead. I mentioned last week on this program that we had the Scottish Rite Temple in our town.
Yeah.
And he was a member of the Scottish Rite. He was a Shriner.
Oh, boy.
Nobody else in the family went into that. Nobody, just him. I could tell. Well, there were a lot of stories that went around about him. Everybody knew kind of how he was, but he really liked me when I was a little girl. He used to pinch my cheeks.
Your family were Swabians? Donau Schwaben?
Yes.
Yeah, I think Schwabians have a reputation for being like that, actually.
Well, now, I'm not. You're always having these things you say about classifying people.
Yeah, well, my family were Swabians, too. Okay. Nor, oh, yeah, my father would pinch pennies, you wouldn't believe. Nor is landlordism itself reprehensible, things being what they are, unless it is antisocial and anti-American. And just here is where it gets point. Some of the oldest and most sacred shrines of Americanism in the East have entirely lost their character as such by the invasion, not of foreigners, but of Jews. The more one sees of this invasion, the more one utterly distrusts the statistics given out by Jews as to the Jewish population of the United States. Do you know that the one nationality on which the government of the United States is stopped from asking questions, either for immigration or census statistics, is the Jewish? Do you know that when the government of the United States wants to know anything about the Jews, it must go to statisticians which the Jews themselves support?
See, I thought that was pretty terrible. Well, of course, it's true. You know, but it's like we know how much power they have today, but they did already. They managed to keep, what would you say, keep government out of their business and make them go to their agencies or whatever for get answers from them about everything to do with themselves.
Well, there's such a cloud of mystery about who is a Jew and who isn't that you almost have to take their word for it. Because if you don't, then you're making accusations, and they'll call you a nut, you know. If a nation claims that it is no nation with respect to the United States government, as the Jews claim, and has no national statistics which it will permit the government to collect in the official way, why should it treat itself as a nation and keep its own records? The Jews of the United States, like the Jews of every European country, are a nation among themselves, with their own government, their own policy, their own records. And the United States government does business with the Jewish government in America through chosen Jews. No doubt of that.
Well, that's another powerful statement. You know, I mean, this should be questioned. Well, you gave an answer to it, saying that, well, I think it just, they have a way, ability to just stymie people. Look at what I was reading, what was in that Rosenberg book, going way back, and all of those Gentile, what we call them, or Christian, or whatever they were, or whatever we were, the non-Jewish majority, all of their political leaders, the government people, tended to get flummoxed by the Jews and go along with the Jews and give the Jews their way and this and that and just really show a lot of preference to Jews when there was no reason at all to do it.
Yeah.
And we see how this is the same kind of thing where the government says, well, okay, we'll deal with your leaders as a special group.
Yeah. In some cases, I think Freemasonry has something to do with that. In other cases, it's Christian Zionism. It is, however, a digression. The matter of Jewish statistics will come up again. In the meantime, a glance at the rapid changing of so many American cities in all parts of the land leads to the belief that the Jewish statistics furnished by the Jews for Gentile consumption entirely misstate the facts. And this belief is strengthened by the knowledge that the statistics given by the Jews for Jewish consumption are very different from those supplied for the outside world. Landlordism may be explained by the inclination of the Jew toward speculation. And we know that real estate has been made one of the most speculative of occupations, disgracefully, almost disastrously so. The Jew cannot be condemned for becoming a landlord, for becoming the most conspicuous landlord in America. He cannot be condemned apart from his Gentile co-offenders for the abuse he has made of his advantage as landlord. But it is a matter for American concern that the cities to which, in the school books, our children are taught to look as the birthplaces of liberty and as still the spokesmen of Americanism, should become Semite cities, financially and politically, and the recruiting grounds of the world's Bolshevism.
Huh. I thought that was pretty darn interesting. And this can get you riled up, too. What they've done to our cities. Well, what cities would they be talking about? New York? Philadelphia?
New York City, most obviously.
Yeah, most. But it can't be only that. Philadelphia?
Plenty of Jews in Philadelphia, too.
Yeah, and Boston.
Yeah.
Just those three are the real basic American history cities, you know, historic cities, which are just, well, Boston is pretty nice now, I guess, but of course New York has its glamorous part, but still, Philadelphia is a mess.
Until recently, however, the Jew in America has not cared for the land. It is a characteristic. The Jew is not an agriculturalist, or an agriculturist, it says. Lavish fortunes have been expended to make him so, but the productive work of farming has not had, and does not now have, any appeal to him. His choice in land is this, land that produces gold from the mine, and land that produces rents. Land that produces mere potatoes and wheat has not directly interested him. It is true, of course, that the land question has been distinctly Jewish in countries like Poland and Romania. No law against Jews owning land in those countries has ever been effective in preventing their control of whole provinces. Not that the Jews demand the right to farm the land. Their choice was to farm the farmers. Hmm. By devious methods and the use of Gentile fronts, they could always secure control of the land, and thus dominating the peasants, they could create almost any condition they wished. That is what they actually did. That is the Jewish question in those parts of the world. Not for farming purposes, it must be understood, but for the purpose of controlling the main source of wealth in agricultural countries, and for taking the control of the people away from their natural Gentile leaders.
You know, just think when you're, what they're saying there, that these devious methods and the use of Gentile fronts and how they can secure control of the land and so on. And they're writing this in this American weekly newspaper that Ford is putting out to his dealership, through his dealerships, and making lots and lots of charges against the Jews and very negative against the Jews. No wonder they call it anti-Semitic. And yet, you know, it was acceptable. It was accepted for a long time by, you know, a lot of people liked it and read it and so on. But yeah. it is really strong stuff that they say that, well, we can say things like this today on the internet, but you can't very well if you want to be a, if you want to be considered a respectable person, you can't very well say it.
Well, there was some pretty, much more frank discussion in the regular press in the early 20th century than we're used to seeing these days. I mean, if you look in the New York Times, you'll see articles about, you know, how many Jews are really anarchists and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some rabbi explaining not all Jews are anarchist bomb throwers, you know.
Yeah, well, because there were a lot then. They don't have to be anarchists now, but they sure were then.
Yeah. These two things always go together in countries where there is intellectual or landed aristocracy to which the people look for leadership. The Jewish program is to destroy that leadership by gaining control of the land. It is profitable, of course, but when you survey the outworking of the plan, you always see something other than profits involved. The consummate perfection of the Jewish plan for world control is that it does not involve sacrifice as have other plans. It is immensely profitable at every stage, and the greater the profitableness, the more surely the purpose is being achieved.
You know, that's pretty interesting. When we, you know, we tend to talk about, you know, well, let's, you know, if we sacrifice and get somewhere, or you know, let's all, it's going to cost us something, but we have to pay the price and so on. But for the Jews, they figure it out so that they gain as much as they can without, and then they benefit while they're doing it.
Yeah.
They enrich themselves while they're doing it. Now this is, you know, you could call this really smarts, but it's just that they have that ruthlessness and that they despise everyone else. So this is the way they look at it, and it really does fit what's in the protocols too. You know, I mean, it just fits that whole point of view.
Well, another way you could look at it is since their strategy is profitable at every step, it doesn't really have to be calculated for the long, long term. It doesn't really have to all be a conspiracy. It could just be their way of operating that leads them to where they go.
Well, yes, you can. You can. I think that's not as convincing, but I know what you're saying. So then you don't have to have a world control plan for world control.
That's right.
You're just having a plan for how can we, I think that might be a way to disarm us from really seeing what they're up about by that argument that, well, Jews just like to make money. They just want to make money. And that's all they're about.
There's more to it than that. I mean, you know, Kevin McDonald talks about, you know, how they have perceived racial interests that go beyond just making money. You know, this business of promoting diversity is something they do so that they can be more secure. You know, weakening the majority is the way to make their position.
Oh, that's right. And ultimate security. I got some in my throat all
the time. You can find
who's
actually saying
ultimate security is to be in control of everything.
Yeah.
Then they're really secure, right?
Well, certain positions of control would make them very secure.
Yeah.
In America, there was no aristocracy to be cut under by the gaining of land control. Jewish activity in the United States until recently has confined itself to the control of land products after they have been produced. That is to say, Jewish interests do not engage in trapping, but they control the fur trade. Mm-hmm. Speaking of furs, it is very funny to see how some affairs turn out. During the war, there was a great to-do made about the German control of the American fur trade. It was true that the fur trade was controlled from Germany, but not by Germans, by Jews. And then a great to-do was made about seizing, confiscating, and absolutely selling out that German fur business to Americans. And the Americans who bought it were Jews.
That really is funny.
The control has never changed. The profits still find their way to the international purse. But furs is just an example. Jewish interests do not engage in raising grain, but control the grain that others produce. The need of the United States is a who's who of Jewish financiers, that the people may identify the men about whom they read as having made this corner or sprung that coup. These interests, which have simply grabbed American-produced wealth and made American consumers pay and pay and pay, have been able to operate almost openly because of the sheer blindness of the American people as they read the newspapers. And of course, while the American newspaper will gladly inform you that this man is an Italian and that man a Pole and the other man a Briton, it will never tell you that the fourth man is a Jew. There is a Jewish organization in every city, large and small, to prevent it. And they prevent it by methods that are violent and wholly subversive of the American ideal of liberty.
Hear, hear. Good for these guys. They're fed up, too. You know, they're fed up. A Jewish organization in every city. Let's see. The ADL had already been established in 1913. So that, along with B'nai B'rith and its, you know, which is, of course, the ADL is from, also B'nai B'rith, but they have other organizations, and then a few others. And then, the American Jewish Congress was very big at that time, or was it the American Jewish Committee? But there's, you know, there's a bunch of them that have been around forever. And they're there busy working all the time to look out for Jewish interests. And we should have that. And we have never, we can't seem to manage to have it. Even when we do start something, it doesn't last. Is that just typical of majorities, or is that us?
I think it's partly because we're Northern Europeans, and Northern Europeans tend to be individualist.
Well, We tend to think if we have our own stock
of food and keep our own powder dry, that's enough.
But even when we know that's not enough and we try to do something, we don't seem to be able to do it.
We can't do it like they do. We have to perceive that we're being attacked. We are.
But there's too many of them that won't perceive that. Boy, they're stubborn.
It's because because we don't control mass media, that's why it's not perceived as much as it could be.
That's true. So, when did they actually get control of the mass media? Do you have a kind of a date for that? Now, how far back?
I think the Jews got in on the ground floor of broadcasting. You know, I'm not sure if a Jew started RCA or not, but Sarnoff ran it, you know, or took it over, and that was NBC then, RCA and NBC. And then RCA, NBC pretty much dominated radio for a while, I think. I think they got in on the ground floor of radio, so that would be 1920s. And they already owned a lot of newspapers in the United States at the beginning of the 20th century, but not as many as they eventually did.
So that was, but when they got it, when we got into radio and television and, of course, motion pictures, they were right there.
Yeah, and they, of course, they set up Hollywood and put Edison out of business.
Yeah, right.
So you can say early 20th century.
And you think that can happen without some kind of centralized mind directing it? You really think that these Jews can just somehow know and just go after stuff without some central plan?
Well, you know, it mentions earlier in the International Jew that that they got financing from across the ocean. So it doesn't have to be centrally organized, but they had enough cooperation that when some Jew was in a position to make some kind of, build some kind of empire or something, there was another Jew that would.
You know, if they got, that's right, that financing, if the financing came from Europe, then we go right back to that central plan there.
It doesn't have to be central.
It's the home of it. Well,
but they've got enough
planned by the wealthiest people there.
Some resources that they're able to do these things.
Well, don't they have to have a big picture in mind to motivate them to keep going? I think so. I think they have a big plan that they can refer to, and that's what they can look to see if they're on track and, you know, if they're going along the way they should. And that keeps them motivated. Otherwise, Jews could get unmotivated too and just say, well, I've got my stuff, you know, like we do. I've got mine, so I'm okay, you know. I'm an individual and I'm taking care of my family.
Yeah.
Something missing if you don't add
that. They do chase after centers of power and status.
They do. And they know that they need that. Well, if you look back into the Middle Ages, like in Rosenberg's book and others, that you see that they saw that they always tried to get close to the leaders and the rulers. And well, that goes even back before the Middle Ages. You know, they did that. They always did that. So that's something that they must have gotten ingrained into their DNA or something. I mean, so into their cultural thinking. That
well,
we
who, knows,
have,
who knows?
We
what's
were
in the film.
Leaders. We thought we had it made. Go ahead.
Who knows what's in the Talmud? You know, it could be all this stuff could be all schematized already in the Talmud. For all I know, I don't know. So until recently, the plan in the United States has been to seize the commodity at just that point in its passage from producer to consumer, where the heaviest weight of profit can be extracted from it. At the neck of the bottle, so to speak, and control it there. It is not service that people pay for. They pay for seizure, the Jewish middleman. But a new movement has begun in the United States. Jewish millions are now being used to secure immense tracts of American lands. Formerly, it was enough to control the cotton, as the bread was controlled. But now the movement is toward controlling the cotton lands. The operations are carefully guarded. Gentile fronts are used almost exclusively, but follow the trail through all the blinds and false scents, and you come at last to the international Jew, whose throne is set up in London. I have a note here. A.K. Chesterton, in his book, The New Unhappy Lords, which I read years ago, said that the center of Jewish financial power shifted to New York City after World War I, or around that time.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people who think that, and this idea that London is still the center is altogether wrong. And who was it that I'd like to get a hold of him, but he doesn't answer emails anymore. That German-American who I interviewed quite a few times, a year and a half ago. I can't think of his last name, but he always said that. I think he was very good at following all of this and how explaining it. And he said it was New York was the financial center of the world and the controlling center of the world since probably about the time you're saying, not London.
Yeah. Yeah, actually probably before World War One they did that. Many Jews have written the Dearborn Independent saying that they do not know about these racial plans for world control. It may well be believed that they do not. One purpose of these articles is to tell them about it. But this every Jew rejoices in. The movement of his people toward power. And it is this sentiment that the international Jew implicitly trusts. And because this sentiment exists, the international program secures a maximum of success at a minimum risk of exposure. Jewry is not a democracy, but an autocracy. Of course, the ordinary Jew does not know. The question is, why should he revile the Gentile who tries to tell him? If a Jew will not seal his mind against the statements made in these articles, he will find in his own knowledge sufficient corroboration of their principal features, and he will be in a better position to assist the solution of the Jewish question.
Well, see, they're still trying to get Jews to listen. They're still trying to find those good Jews who are reasonable and don't know about this and would be horrified if they realized what's really going on. And if just some of those would listen, maybe we'd make some progress. See, but have we ever been able to get them to know? And they say here that the Jew takes pleasure in every Jew rejoices in the movement of his people toward power.
Yeah,
and that's true. You know, we have today in these articles and so on where they write about, oh, we control Hollywood, and all every Jew says, well, why not? Good. If you read the comments that Jews make or whatever, you know, everything is like, oh, as much as we Jews can do for ourselves, that's all for the good. And the same with Negroes now. As you know, they have the same attitude. Well, whatever we can do for us as the black race, well, that's what we'll do. It's good for us, and that's all we care about. And how many, 95%, that's shocking, 95% of American African Americans voted for Obama. 95%.
Yeah.
You know, that tells you right there what the heck's going on. And now they don't make it. They won't tell you how many Jews voted. Because again, Jews don't want to say, yeah, they do. But most of them don't want to say they're Jews. So, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you have that problem identifying them.
Yeah. It is with amazement at certain men's conception of editorial honesty that the Dearborn Independent has read some of the reports made of these articles. Under cover, principally of the Yiddish, alleged translations of these articles have been flung broadcast among non-English-speaking Jews. Translations which not only bear no resemblance to the original, but actually insert whole paragraphs of matter which never appeared in the original at all. Is there a fear of permitting the average Jew to read this series? Nothing is more desirable by those whose purpose it is to lay foundations for the solution of the Jewish question in America than that every Jew in the United States should know exactly what is being printed here week by week. The Jew has been deceived by his leaders long enough.
So they're saying that translations of this in Yiddish are being put out there for Jews who can speak Yiddish, and they're not accurate, and add stuff, and they do all this stuff to make it look like, oh, look what they're saying about us. Yeah, I do too.
The fact is, then, that there is a definite and already well-forwarded movement toward the control of the cotton lands of the United States. The first step was to depreciate the market value of these lands as much as possible. Pressure was brought through certain banks to limit the cotton farmers' efforts. They were told that if they planted more acreage to cotton than they were told to, they would not be financed. Cotton production was to go down while cotton prices were to go up, and the profits were not the farmers, but those who controlled the course of cotton from the first market to the wearer. Cotton farming was to be made less profitable, while cotton speculation was to become more profitable. The public was being compelled to supply the money by which the Jewish controllers were to buy the land. In brief, it was to be made more profitable to sell cotton lands than to sell cotton. These statements are being deliberately restricted to the traffic in cotton lands. Jewish financiers in New York and London know these things, even if Jewish editors and rabbis do not. This movement has been within the knowledge of certain classes of businessmen for a long time. Indeed, some have been forced by what used to be called the pressure of circumstances to serve the movement. But they were not able to interpret its meaning. It is only recently that the more important Gentile businessmen of the United States have been able to interpret certain things. The war was a potent eye-opener. Those wonderful documents known as the Protocols, with their strong grasp of every element of life, have not overlooked land. The land program is found in the Sixth Protocol, which is one of the briefest of these documents and may be quoted in full to show now the relation it bears to certain excerpts made in previous articles. Okay, Shmuley, you're on.
Okay, Protocol 6. We shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, colossal reservoirs of wealth upon which even the big Gentile properties will be dependent to such an extent that they will all fall together with the government credit on the day following the political catastrophe. The economists here present must carefully weigh the significance. They mean the Jewish economists who are present wherever he's speaking this, must carefully weigh the significance of this combination. We must develop by every means the importance of our super government, representing it as the protector and benefactor of all who voluntarily submit to us. The aristocracy of the Gentiles as a political force has passed away. We need not take them into consideration. But as owners of the land, they are harmful to us in that they are independent in their source of livelihood. Therefore, at all costs, we must deprive them of their land. The best means to attain this is to increase the taxes and mortgage indebtedness. These measures will keep land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination. Unable to satisfy their needs by small inheritances, the aristocrats among the Gentiles will burn themselves out rapidly. At the same time, it is necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation, the function of which is to act as a counterpoise to industry. Without speculation, industry will cause private capital to increase and tend to improve the condition of agriculture. By freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by the land banks, improve the condition of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness. It is necessary for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and capital, and through speculations, transfer all the money of the world into our hands, thereby throwing the Gentiles into the ranks of the proletariat. The Gentiles will then bow before us to obtain the right to existence. To destroy Gentile industry, we shall, as an incentive to this speculation, encourage among Gentiles a strong demand for luxuries, all enticing luxuries. We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to workers, for we will at the same time cause a rise in the prices of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and of cattle raising. We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy and encourage them in the use of alcohol, at the same time taking measures to drive all the intellectual forces of the Gentiles from the land. That the true situation shall not be noticed by the Gentiles prematurely, we will mask it by a pretended effort to serve the working classes and promote the great economic principles for which an active propaganda will be carried on through our economic theories. Well, that's like these bad economists, huh, who are always telling us to follow their newfangled theories. Probably.
The local and passing element in this is the aristocracy of the Gentiles. That is to say, the program is not entirely fulfilled by the passing of aristocrats. Jewry goes on just the same. His program stretches far. Jewry will retain such kings as it desires as long as it desires them. Probably the last throne to be vacated will be the British throne, because what to the British mind is the honor of being Jewry's protector, and therefore the inheritor of the blessing which that attitude brings, is to the Jewish mind the good fortune of being able to use a worldwide empire for the furtherance of Jewry's purpose. Each has served the other, and the partnership will probably last until Jewry gets ready to throw Britain over, which Jewry can do at almost any time. There are indications that it has already started on this last task. But the permanent elements in this protocol are the land, the Jews, and the Gentiles. A word of explanation may be necessary on this inclusion of the Gentiles as permanent. The protocols do not contemplate the extermination of the Gentiles, nor the making of this world a completely Jewish-populated world. The protocols contemplate a Gentile world ruled by the Jews. The Jews as masters, the Gentiles as hewers of wood and drawers of water, a policy which every Old Testament reader knows to be typically Jewish and the source of divine judgment upon Israel time and again. So then you don't need to get that from the protocols. You can get it from the Old Testament. Now,
well,
look at
the Old Testament doesn't quite point it out the way the protocols does. I don't think we would get all that from the Old Testament. We never did get any of that. We never learned any of this stuff from the Old Testament. And because we had a totally different point of view of what the Old Testament was about, yeah, and was there to tell us.
A lot of that stuff is in Isaiah and Deuteronomy.
It is, but we don't see it, you know, as affecting us in any way. It's stuff that was said about those people back then.
Mm-hmm. Now look at this whole program as it concerns the land.
Owners of the land are harmful to us in that they are independent of in their sources of livelihood.
That is a foundation principle of the protocols. It matters not whether the owners are the Gentile aristocracy, the peasants of Poland, or the farmers of the United States. Land ownership makes the owners independent in their sources of livelihood. Mm-hmm. And any form of independence is fatal to the success of the world program, which is written so comprehensively in the protocols and which is advancing so comprehensively under Jewish guidance in the world of actual affairs today. Not tillers of the land, not dwellers on the land, not tenants, not an agricultural peasantry, but owners of the land. This is the class singled out for attention in this sixth protocol because they are independent in their sources of livelihood.
Now, well, absolutely true, and I'll have something to say about that when we finish.
Okay. Now, there has been no time in the history of the United States when apparently it was more easy for the farmer to own his land than now. Mortgages should be a thing of the past. Everywhere the propaganda of the question tells us that the farmers are growing rich, and yet there were never so many abandoned farms. Therefore, Shmuley, you can read that.
Therefore, at all costs, we must deprive them of their land.
How?
The best means to attain this is to increase land taxes and mortgage indebtedness.
High taxes to keep the land at all. Borrowed money to finance the tilling of it.
These measures will keep land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination.
We will leave it to the farmers of the United States to say whether this is working out or not. And in a future reference to this subject, we will show that whenever an attempt is made to enable farmers to borrow money at decent rates, whenever it is proposed to lighten the burden of mortgage indebtedness on the farm, Jewish financial influence in the United States steps in to prevent it, or failing to prevent it, mess it all up in the operation. By increasing the farmer's financial disability on the one hand, and by increasing industrial allurements on the other, a very great deal is accomplished. The protocol says,
it is necessary for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and capital.
Has that been done? Have the farms of the United States been depleted both of laborers and capital? Certainly. Money is harder for the farmer to get than it is for any other man. And as for labor, he cannot get it on any terms.
Yeah, how many people want to be farm laborers by that time? When you could go to the city and work in a factory or something and not out there, you know, in the mud and so on. Nobody wanted to be a farm laborer. That was about as low as anything could be.
What is the result of these two influences, the one working on the farm and the other in the cities? It is precisely what the protocol says it will be. Increased wages that buy less of the materials of life. Shmuley.
We will, at the same time, cause a rise in the prices of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and cattle raising.
The Jew who set these protocols in order was a financier, economist, and philosopher of the first order. He knew what he was talking about. His operations in the ordinary world of business always indicated that he knew exactly what he was doing. How well this sixth protocol has worked and is still working out in human affairs is before the eyes of everyone to see. Here in the United States, one of the most important movements toward real independence of the financial powers has been begun by the farmers. The farmer's strong advantage is that, owning the land, he is independent in his sources of livelihood. The land will feed him whether he pleases international Jewish financiers or not. His position is impregnable as long as the sun shines and the seasons roll. It was, therefore, necessary to do something to hinder this budding independence. He was placed under a greater disadvantage than any other businessman in borrowing capital. He was placed more ruthlessly than any other producer between the upper and nether stones of a thievish distribution system. Labor was drawn away from the farm. The Jew-controlled melodrama made the farmer a rube, and Jew-made fiction presented him as a hick, causing his sons to be ashamed of farm life. The grain syndicates which operate against the farmer are Jew-controlled. There is no longer any possibility of doubting, when the facts of actual affairs are put alongside the written program, that the farmer of the United States has an interest in this question. What would this world program gain if the wage workers were enslaved and the farmers were allowed to go scot-free? Therefore, the program of agricultural interference, which has been only partially outlined here. But this is not all. Any writer who attempts fully to inform the Gentile mind on the Jewish question must often feel that the extent of the protocol's conspiracy is so great as to stagger the Gentile mind. Gentiles are not conspirators. They cannot follow a clue through long and devious and darkened channels. The elaborate completeness of the Jewish program, the perfect coordination of its mass of details wearies the Gentile mind. This, really more than the daring of the program itself, constitutes the principal danger of program being fulfilled. Gentile mental laziness is the most powerful ally the world program has.
Well, now, I wouldn't accuse you of mental laziness, but I will say that you don't like following what the protocols lays out. They say that it wearies your mind. It doesn't appeal to you. You don't like, and you've admitted that it's unpleasant to you. You don't like even reading about it. And I think that's kind of true. You know, I think the point they're making here is really true.
I just think it goes too far and it's not authentic. Well, it goes too far. It blames Jews for a little bit too much.
But what? Well, you know, but if it's teaching us something important about what is going on, we shouldn't let a couple little things like that bother us. But it's because we don't like it. We don't like reading stuff like that. We don't like thinking about it. I really think there's a lot of truth to that. It doesn't suit our nature, where it does seem to suit theirs.
I prefer the explanation offered by evolutionary psychology rather than
that's not the same. That doesn't take care of the same things, and it doesn't give us any power or any strength either. But let's finish this before we start arguing about that.
For example, after citing the perfectly obvious coincidence and most probable connection between the protocols and the observable facts with reference to the farm situation, the writer is compelled to say, as above, but this is not all. And it is a peculiarity of Gentile psychology that the Gentile reader will feel that it ought to be all because it is so complete. This is where the Jewish mind outmaneuvers the Gentile mind. Gentiles may do a thing for one reason. The Jew often does the same thing for three or four reasons. The Gentile can understand, thus far, why Jewish financiers should seek control of the land in order to prevent widespread agricultural independence, which, as Protocol 6 says, would be harmful to us. That reason is perfectly clear. But there is another. It is found in the 12th Protocol. It contemplates nothing less than the playing of city against country in the great game now being exposed. Complete control over the city by the industrial leverage and over the country by the debt leverage will enable the hidden players to move first the country by saying that the city demands certain things, and then move the city by saying that the country demands certain things, thus splitting citizens and farmers apart and using them against one another. Look at the plainness and the boldness, yet the calm assurance with which this plan is broached.
Our calculations reach out, especially into the country districts. There we must necessarily arouse those interests and ambitions which we can always turn against the city, representing them to the cities as dreams and ambitions for independence on the part of the provinces. I don't follow that, but it is clear that the source of all this will be precisely the same and that it will come from us. It will be necessary for us, before we have attained full power, to so arrange matters that, from time to time, the city shall come under the influence of opinion in the country districts, that is, of the majority prearranged by our agents.
The preliminaries of the game are here set forth. To jockey city and farm against each other, that in the end the conspirators may use whichever proves the stronger in putting the plan over. In Russia, both schemes have been worked. The old regime, established in the cities, was persuaded to lay down power because it was made to believe that the peasants of Russia requested it. Then, when the Bolshevists seized power, they ruled the peasantry on the ground that the cities wanted it. The cities listened to the country, now the country is listening to the cities. If you see any attempt made to divide city and farm into antagonistic camps, remember this paragraph from the 12th Protocol. Already the poison is working. Have you never heard that prohibition was something which the backwoods districts forced upon the cities? Have you never heard that the high cost of living was due to extravagant profits of the farmer? Profits which he doesn't get. One big dent in this program of world control could be made if the citizen and the farmer could learn each other's mind. Not through self-appointed spokesmen, but directly from each other. City and farm are drifting apart because of misrepresentation of outsiders. And in the widening rift, the sinister shadow of the world program appears. By the way, that's the kind of division between segments of society that National Socialism specifically tried to bridge.
You're right.
Let the farmers look past the Gentile fronts in their villages or principal trading points, past them to the real controllers who are hidden.
Well, you know, they're talking here. That's the end, ladies and gentlemen, of this chapter, September 4th, 1920. They're talking here of the cities and the farms in a way that doesn't really exist anymore, because we don't have all those. We have some, but we don't have the number of family farms that we used to, and so much of agriculture is industrial.
Yeah, it used to be the vast majority of Americans were farmers.
Yeah, and now, and you know, as you mentioned, National Socialism, they're part of their program is to get people back on the farm, to have a lot of farmers, because they thought in terms of feeding themselves, which we never think of anymore. We don't think we need to feed ourselves. We've always had plenty of excess, you know, foods or something. So, and then we just get them from all over the world. So,
there's also the healthfulness of farm life, the wholesomeness of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this fact that Thomas Jefferson points out I think in the Federalist Papers, Jefferson placed a very high value on that the United States should continue to be a country of yeoman farmers, because the small farmer, with his economic independence, he's able to be free. Somebody that works for a factory and has to worry about what his boss thinks doesn't really have freedom, no matter how much is given in the Constitution.
That's right. And speaking of that, the thing I wanted to bring up from earlier about getting people to sell their land and not to be landowners. And, you know, I know that for myself, we've only got 60 seconds left. I know that for myself, I'm caught into that, because I at times could have owned property, could have kept property. I didn't want to. I always saw too much ownership as too much responsibility. And I guess being a single female, if I had had a partner to do that with who wanted to do it, it would have been different. But, you know, I didn't feel like I knew how to take care of things well enough. And I thought, well, stuff is always going wrong, and then you've got all these taxes. You don't know what's going to happen with prices. So I chose to take the money, and then invest money, you know, rather than own ownership. And that's a big mistake. And a lot of us have done that. It is a big mistake.
I can see a big trend in the United States back to the land.
Well, I hope so. That would
Small
be great.
Farming is where security is.
It is true. That's true. That's the message of this chapter, folks. So hope you get that message and spread it around. Come back next week. Good night.
Rage on, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.